once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
Here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach on this February 17th, Saturday in the year 2018. Telephone number to call in here is 254-947-11. No, it's not. 254-773-1400. Yeah, my brain is slipping. I said at the end of the last, you got something before I start into this?
No, you go ahead. You said you were
going to talk about something. I said at the end of the first hour today, February 17th, 2018, that I had some shocking news.
Shocking. Well, that's how you refine aluminum.
Yeah, that's true. Aluminium.
Oh, yes.
But you have to have it has to be in the absence of oxygen, though.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is probably one of my problems. Anyway.
Shocking.
Thursday of this week. Now, the word was out there already because the Secretary of the Treasury had already warned this was coming. But they made the official announcement this week that next week, the Treasury Department of the United States would need to borrow $250 billion.
Next week.
Next week. That's in like 1 week.
1 week. And there's one. How many auctions do they do during the week?
There's a bunch of them. I don't remember. There's 8 or 10 auctions. So, but they're separate auctions for separate amounts of money. Separate amounts.
That's quite an auction. $250 billion.
And why are they borrowing $250 billion? Well, two things. One, we had a tax cut. And as a result, they are anticipating less taxes this year. So they need to borrow some money. Some money. We've had a massive increase in spending. A lot of that goes into effect very quickly. And so the Treasury needs to borrow. Let me listen to this number again. In this coming week, the Treasury of the United States has announced it's going to go to market, and they call it selling securities, bills, bonds, and notes.
What it really is borrowing money.
They're going to borrow money in the amount of $258 billion. That's over $250 billion. Now, if they did that for 4 weeks, they'd borrow $1 trillion. Now, they're not going to do that 4 weeks in a row, obviously, but the deficit the year before the current administration took over, when they said we need to reduce the deficit, I'll balance the budget in how many years? When he was running for office, it was just a few years he was going to balance the budget.
It's like 6 years, something like that.
The deficit was running a little over $500 billion a year. The deficit, according to the administration, and we haven't got the final word in on that, the numbers will probably be higher from elsewhere, will run about $887 billion this year. In 2019 to 2020 range, it's forecast by literally everybody, including the administration, the deficit, the annual deficit of the United States government will be $1.15 trillion per year. I want you to listen to that just a second.
Annually. That's like every year.
These are the people who were complaining that under the Obama administration, when they ran a $558 billion deficit because of stimulus that they threw in, that it was unsustainable, it would destroy the nation, and they were very, 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 very upset about it. We had people calling in on the radio program here talking about how terrible it was that the Obama administration was going to run this $500 billion deficit.
Which was disgusting at the time. Still, I mean, that's too big a deficit.
Now, $558 trillion, you multiply it times two.
That's where we are.
And we have a plan at the federal level to run a deficit in 2019, and that's the plan, to double the deficit from the highest one that we had before, because it's a really good idea. And I have asked somebody who supports this, who supports the president, his policies, who supports the idea that the Republican Party, who voted almost, it was a party line vote, to increase the deficit to an astronomical quantity of money that is beyond my comprehension. And it's one thing to say, well, out in the future, this is going to happen. Don't believe, you don't have to take my word for it. You can go online to the U.S. Treasury site and see the announcement of auctions for next week. and you will note if you add them up, they're going to borrow a quarter of a trillion dollars next week, and they need to, because, you know, it's like General Bull Moose in the Little Abner comic strip, who said, "I want all the money in the world because I need it."
Right.
It's like, I'm going to borrow all the money in the world because I need it.
Now, right.
Now, do I think, by the way, do I think that the causes that this money is going to are bad causes? No. There's no question in my mind
that
the military needs more money.
Right.
There's no question in my mind that
to pay Social Security.
We have to pay Social Security. We have to pay Medicare. We've committed to do those things. We have to pay pensions. All the things that this money is going to, I've looked at it and I said, you know, I don't see anything wrong with any of that. The problem I see, and very frankly, the problem that is overwhelming to me, is raising spending by a very substantial amount, which we need to do, while at the same time effectively giving a 20% tax cut across the board to taxpayers. Now, Mark Zandi, who's the guy that I think the most highly of, he's the guy who called the mortgage bond implosion a year before it happened, and everybody was laughing at him, and then he turned out to be right, and he's been right ever since on everything that's happened. Makes an interesting point. He said, when the United States government runs a deficit like it's running, the ratio is 0.6 to 1, meaning for every dollar that the government borrows and spends, it increases the GDP down the road by 60 cents. That's a good way to go out of business. Now, if there's other things that the government can do that do increase the GDP, and there are things that, but the best they ever get is 1 to 1. The issue, like for instance, if they do go for, if the government does spend $200 billion more dollars, as the infrastructure proposal suggests, on infrastructure in the United States, that $200 billion will increase the GDP about $1 for every dollar the government spends. Now, on the other hand, if the government keeps interest rates low by not borrowing too much money, in other words, keeps the tax rates back where they were, allows the deficit to gradually wind itself down, do whatever is needed, and whenever we decide to spend more money, raise taxes to cover it, which makes a great deal of sense from my perspective, then things like building houses will accelerate because interest rates stay low. Now, when a new house gets built, a custom house, for example, every dollar that goes into that custom house produces between $8 and $16 in the GDP of the United States because of all the other things that have to go into it to right. build it. So
let's – I mean, at the beginning of this tax thing, we were fully on board with the idea of, number one, let's say tax rates for corporate America were too high.
Right.
Way too high. It was causing them to put businesses elsewhere rather than here. So the president said when he was running for office and after, he wanted to – drop that corporate tax rate. We were fully on board with that. Not because we think corporations are angels or anything like that. We think that corporations are businesses. And when they're taxed at the highest rate in the world, that's not good. Long term, that's going to put us out of competition. So we dropped that. That's great. He also said, let's simplify the personal income tax side of things. We're also totally on board with that. What we got out of it, though, was the corporate tax drop. Yay, good job. And more complex personal income tax with a tax cut in the personal side. And we scratched our head about that. Nobody promised that. That wasn't something that was on the agenda at all. Simplification of the personal tax code was part of it.
And it complexified.
It complexified. And suddenly we had a tax drop. Now, I'm not complaining because I like the fact that I've got to pay less money this year to the IRS than I did last year. That's fantastic.
Oh, by the way, I was reading about the business 20% tax cut.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a simplified article by a very, very good writer who's also a CPA.
Yeah.
And after the fourth page, my mind was boggled. And I'm just glad that there's computer programs that maybe can
right,
figure this out.
The complexity of the tax code. There's no logic. Just forget that. Throw that out. Logic, long, long, long time ago, logic left the tax code. There's no reason for a lot of this stuff. There was a reason originally that's been warped and modified so many times that it's just spaghetti. There's a bunch of spaghetti in the tax code that says follow the noodle. And it's really that logical. It doesn't make sense. So if you think about why the rates are where they are, the whole concept that we're saying here is that we didn't simplify the tax code, which means that we still have that ahead of us sometime. We've got to do it because it's too insane.
Listen, the Byzantine Empire lasted for hundreds and hundreds of years and is still famous for one thing, and that is the complexity of its tax code.
And our tax code is so much more complex than the Byzantine Empire's. I mean, it makes the Byzantine Empire look like Sudoku. Sudoku, it's a little bit complex, but not that hard. You just get it. Hey, you can tell your answers are all right. You cannot tell that with our tax code. You can look at our tax code and say, did I do this right? To nine different people and get nine different answers.
So if there's anyone actually listening and you have the ability to make notes, note this down and we'll see whether it's right or wrong. I'm not smart enough to figure this out, but Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics, who, like I said, is the guy who's been so consistently right for the past 15 years, it's scary. This is his forecast. We will see an acceleration of GDP and business doings in the United States this year and into next year. Towards the end of 2019, we'll start to stall out.
Yeah, when you take off in a jet or any other airplane and you put the throttle to the wall, you just max it out and pull the stick back as hard as you can to get a good climb out of it. Eventually, the engines run out of gas, even if...
They're not a matter of running out of gas. It's just the aerodynamics. The engines can still be running at full speed, but you've exceeded the capacity of the aircraft to climb.
Yeah, the lift is lost.
The GDP of the United States has a sustainable growth rate, you're not going to like this, of between 1.5 and 2% right now, and it's mainly because of labor restrictions.
There's also some infrastructure problems in that we can't transport goods as well as we used to.
Zandi is calling for a 2.6% GDP growth over the next 2 years, which is above our sustainable rate, which means we're going to run out of stuff. Now, coincidentally, and it is coincidentally, the Economist, Wall Street Journal, and other places are reporting that, for instance, automobile manufacturers and other places in the United States are complaining in that they have hit the manufacturers in general are hitting a wall in that they are getting more orders coming in than they can fill. And it isn't a matter of they're not willing to go out and buy new equipment. They are willing to buy new equipment. They're willing to build new plants. They just can't find people to fill the slots.
If you think about taxes or money being the gasoline, and the labor being the oil that makes sure all the parts keep moving in an engine. We're running out of oil, and we're pumping in more gas, and we're pushing the accelerator forward. That causes a seizing of the engine at some point when you get so many orders that people are waiting on it that they don't have enough somewhere down the road. Say they order, a customer comes to one business, they have to order parts to make a product. They have to wait on the parts. Eventually, the customer doesn't need the item anymore. They say, forget it. I don't have a demand for this anymore. And each of those pieces fall apart. It's a freezing of the system, similar in many ways to the freezing of the system on the financial end. We had a frozen gasoline system during the Great Recession. We had money frozen because banks couldn't lend because they didn't know how much they had on hand. So just think about all the gas stations were unable to give gas. That's what froze the system. And now we've got a labor shortage that we're about to exacerbate if we don't immediately really, really get into automation or bring in a bunch of immigrants. We're going to seize up, and that's going to cause failures of businesses that are in other ways profitable.
Now, this is when I said make notes. We have in the United States, and for that matter, it works out around the rest of the developed world too, an amazing history that goes back into the 19th century in that the majority of decade-changing years, plus or minus 1 year, we have a recession. If you think about it, we had one started in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
We were in one in 2010. It actually hit in 2008 and 9, but it was 2010. You can go back in 1990. We had one you go back as far as you want to go. Now, maybe off a year. Sometimes we did have one in 1980. We had another one in 1982. So, but the point is, we have this amazing history of doing this, and there's something to it. And I think it is that we just forget. But the point that Mark Zandi was making, and I think it's very good, is that all of their data suggests that at the end of 2019, the United States will be hitting the wall in its capacity just about everywhere at the same time, and will go into an economic stall that will result in a recession.
And the problem
in 2020. Now, again, it's the round year number.
Yeah, the problem with this kind of a stall, when it's a labor shortage that causes the freezing, it causes companies to go down and disappear because they cannot meet the demand. And that leads to a tidal wave of unable to meet demand type situations where things have been paid for and not delivered. That's a big problem. Bankruptcies result, and that people have paid what they, you know, if you're ordering a big machine and you pay for the machine half in advance and you're expecting the machine in 6 weeks, well, 12 weeks later, it's not there yet. And you call them up and you say, what's going on? They're gone. They're not a company anymore.
Well, that's also compounded by the fact that companies go out and borrow money to buy the machine.
Right. So that company borrowed the other half of the money to put that stuff together, expecting to get paid, and or maybe even a quarter because they've got to make some profit. The first company borrowed money to buy the machine, paid half up front. Now that company that they paid no longer exists, and they've got to eat that cost, and they still have to pay the debt. So there's a chain reaction. If you can't meet the order because you don't have the labor, you shouldn't take the order to begin with. But the last thing you want to do when you're running short on money is say no to a customer when they want to pay you.
You know, I've been asking this for a month. I'd love to have somebody give us a call at 773-1400. Some conservative, a Republican conservative, self-identified, including Lynn Woolley, and explain why it was a good idea to increase the deficit knowingly with malaforethought.
What you're going to find is
by $2 trillion.
Self-identifying long-term Republicans can't defend that because it's not part of what they've defended for their life. They are for it in this case because it was good for the party at the moment. And that's a problem when you give up your principles to make a decision that's good for you short term. It's the kind of like taking the money from the customer when you know you can't fulfill it. It's you gotta stick to your ethics. You gotta say, I got into this to keep the deficit down. Yeah, we have to spend money, and yes, the government needs money. We need taxes for the government, but we don't want overtaxing, and we certainly don't want the lack of a defense capability. So your long-term Republican viewpoint is free markets, low deficits, strong defense, family values. We're still sticking with the strong defense.
Definitely not with the family values.
Not with the family values, not with the low deficits, the low taxes, I suppose, but it's kind of like a seesaw. If you do low taxes and you haven't changed anything else, your deficit goes up. So small government. Well, small government went out the window first.
But I'm really interested in trying to understand this. Among, you know, there are several things that I just lost the name of our former governor.
Rick?
Yeah, Rick Perry is the Secretary of Energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the number one department he wanted to get to eliminate.
Yep.
Why is he not working at eliminating the Department of Energy?
The head of the EPA wanted to eliminate the EPA. Why is he not eliminating the EPA? Well, because he can't. The government has these rules that have been built into place. They just got to be done by the legislature. And we have a caller on 773-1400.
Somebody's going to explain the deficit to
us. We hope so. Please stay calm. Caller on 773-1400, you're on the air.
Hello, Jeff and Jake McClure.
Hello.
Anyway,
you said our names better than we do.
Oh, thank you, thank you. A lot of us so-called conservatives don't like the fact that the Republicans have done what they've done with the deficit.
And so, it's and conservative Republicans did this too, by the way.
Well, I don't know. That's an iffy. You know, I mean, to think that, you know, I know that Trump has governed in a conservative way in some ways, especially the Supreme Court justices. But in other ways, he's not so conservative. It's more like populist or maybe even isolationist. I'm not sure what you would call it.
Nationalist.
Nationalist. That's what you'd probably call it. Although, I don't like the term white nationalist because it used to be white supremacist.
Yeah.
But nowadays, they're calling it white nationalist.
Yeah, I agree with you there. But well, you notice I'm not hammering the president. He's the president.
Yeah, I know.
And we elected him, and we elected the Congress. What I don't understand
is the support.
I have been listening to, whenever I get a chance, I've been listening to conservative talk radio, and I hear them berating a lot of things, including Mueller's investigation and so on, but I don't hear any, you know, and maybe I'm just missing it because I don't listen 24/7, but I don't hear this, hey, all the people who, not all the people, but most of the people who claim to be conservatives in Congress just voted to increase the deficit by $2 trillion. That's bad. Vote them out.
Well,
I don't hear that.
There's one guy that that's on late in the evening, Mark Levin. He doesn't pull any punches. He hates that sort of thing. And, I mean, when Trump does something right, he praises him. When he does something wrong, he sounds worse than somebody talking about Bill Clinton and stuff. I mean, it's amazing to hear Mark Levin.
Well, that's what, let me make something clear here, just in case anybody besides you is listening. Many of the things that Donald Trump has advocated, his administration at least, has advocated are good. You know, we really need to, the military was getting hollowed out and was being asked to do a lot more than we were being paid to do. And running out and having a two-year budget for the military and having increased funding for the military, excellent idea. The reduction in unnecessary regulation for the sake of regulation, excellent idea. I can go down the list, addressing the fact that the Chinese are subsidizing
steel and aluminum,
but starting a trade war in the process is a very bad way to get the job done. But still, the things he's addressing are things that need to be addressed. I don't like the way he's doing it, and there's certain aspects. My blame, I can't do anything about who's president until 4 years are up. I can say that the people we elected to Congress, we conservatives, I think the people who listen by and large are conservatives, are not doing what we elected them to do. They're doing the opposite.
They haven't for a long time, actually. You know, I really wanted to talk about the labor issue for a minute.
Okay, go ahead.
Let me give you something from an experience I had. I once worked for a company that was basically in the advertising business, but they did a lot of manufacturing. And primarily they hired migrant workers, not illegal migrant workers,
mm-hmm.
but migrant workers. And mostly they were from places like Mexico and Guatemala, places like that.
Sure. I got you. I know what you're talking about.
All right. Now, there were American citizens that worked there, but mostly they had office jobs, warehouse jobs, you know, places of authority.
Sure.
The rest were laborers. Now, here's my beef with the whole thing. That company made a tremendous profit. I mean, they didn't have a narrow margin like a lot of service industries do. And they paid those migrant workers very, very little.
Sure.
If they could get away with it, they would just pay them less than minimum wage.
Sure. You're right.
Here's my real beef with the thing. I mean, if somebody didn't want to work there because the pay was bad, they could just leave.
Sure.
But my biggest complaint was that there were horrible conditions in that place. There were some air conditioned areas, you know. I mean, there were some people who had nice little places to work.
Cut to the chase.
But they didn't have fans for the people in the really hot areas, unless you were an American citizen in the warehouse or something. Then you had plenty of fans.
Well,
and the American citizens would walk around like there's nothing wrong. And some of those women mostly wouldn't complain unless they were about to pass out. And when they did complain, the boss would say, if you don't like it, go home.
Well, you know, and let me say that is that company still in business?
Yes.
Okay. That's bad business. And they're probably modifying it. That not only is it bad business, it's proven over the years to be as ineffective and unprofitable over the long term. As technology roars ahead, unless they change that practice, and they change it rather dramatically, they'll be out of business.
I hope so.
It is, you know, it's economics, the laws of economics. You can't cross anything that those people can do that they're treating that way can be done by a machine, and you need an educated person to run the machine. And unless you treat people, if you treat people well and they stay with you, and you support them, and they become better and better educated, then it's a self-sustaining situation. But I would imagine that company is now having a lot of trouble finding those same people to work.
Which means they have to increase wages, and if they don't increase the comfort levels at the same time, then they're going to go out of business.
You know,
now, to be honest, I don't really hate those people or anything. And there were people that worked there since the place started. So it's not like they didn't like working there. I was just commenting on the fact that I think the reason Americans won't work at places like that is that there's no pay in it, and it's really kind of uncomfortable to work there.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that, very frankly, I am in favor but it passed the Senate a few years ago, and the conservatives in the House killed it. There was an immigration bill that said basically we do a survey and say how many laborers do we need to work in uncomfortable situations around the United States at minimum wage, and let's let that many people come into the country with work cards. And there's a reason for that, because even though the situation that you saw was unpleasant, it's probably better than what they had as an alternative where they came from. And
hey, before I go, first I want to say I enjoy your show, but are we in a worldly globe as well as a global world, or
a what?
Oh, never mind.
A worldly globe as well as a globally world?
I don't understand your question.
Well, you said we're in a global world whether we like it or not.
Yes. In other words, we can't say the United States can make it all by itself. It can't.
Can't be just a nation by itself.
There are raw materials, and there's lots of things that we don't have the capability of providing for ourselves, and if we don't bring them in, we're toast.
But to speak to your point, that is a silly turn of phrase that we're calling this a global world now. Well, what was it before?
It was
another kind of world that wasn't a globe.
I should have said we're in a global economy.
And it's just,
okay, thanks for the call. He got me.
He did.
Well, yeah, world is a, you know.
We're in a global world now. Well, what were we before?
But the point is our world isn't necessarily the globe. That's
But it's a small world after all.
It's a small
world. And now we're going to have hate mail over that. They're going to be trying to get that out of their heads for the rest of the day.
And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400, and we probably can run some comicals.
Yes, let's play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Well, we've got a call here real quick.
Yes.
Let's hit the call before we head to commercial.
Let's take the call.
Caller on 773-1400. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Morning. I'm a 22-year military vet.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I'm getting ready to transition out. So I've been through some job fairs, put out applications, haven't heard anything yet. So it gets me wondering exactly what industry is looking for. And in terms of...
Have you contacted an outplacement firm of any kind? An employment firm of any kind?
Not yet.
Okay, I know that sounds really crazy, but Texas Workforce Commission is pretty passive, if that's what you're working through. Are you've talked to them?
I've done some with them.
Okay. First, you make sure you registered with them. You got your resume up to snuff. You get aggressive about that. And in some cases, if you have skills, and that's what you want to do, is find something that matches up to your skills. And if you, what'd you do in the military?
I did chemical operations.
Yeah, well, there's probably not a real big demand for people who can poison other people very effectively.
Well, hey, you know about safety techniques. Yeah. So they, I mean, there's places like Wilson that would snap you up pretty quick, I think.
And I think Fort Hood used to, and I presume they still do, and I know the VA does, have programs that you might, and look into those very carefully and figure out what you want to do. For example, you know, what he said is being getting certified as an EPA specialist, because whether you know it or not, you've actually learned a lot about how to clean up after messes. And I mean, that's what you were doing, right? You practiced cleaning up after things were contaminated.
Yeah, I've got some friends that are former special forces, and they called themselves, in the Army, they called themselves engineers. I'm like, no, that's de-engineering. When it goes boom, it's not the going up thing. But their technique does apply directly to engineering. And when you're talking about being in chemicals, you know how to clean up a site. You know how to do a lot of things. There are quite a lot of extremely lucrative but not quite comfortable professions, whether that's asbestos remediation or lead remediation in old houses.
This is the big thing. There are assets on Fort Hood. There's assets in the VA. Utilize them. Don't just passively put out resumes in a shotgun fashion. Look, because they'll look at your skill set. And I'll be very frank with you. Are you a non-commissioned officer? Or an officer?
Yes.
Okay. What rank?
Sergeant First Class.
Okay. Let me tell you. If you walked in to my business, now we're not hiring anybody right now, we don't have an open slot, but I'm going to tell you, if you walked into our business and you said, I am a sergeant for United States Army, Sergeant First Class with, how many times did you go to Southwest Asia?
Three.
With three tours in Southwest Asia, and I want to work for you. Bingo, you go to the front of the line, because you have proven the discipline and the staying power.
You have proven management skills.
But I didn't say if you sent me a resume. I said if you walked in. So what you've got to do is market yourself by using every resource you can lay your hand on. The VA has a big deal about it. You go to the VA site, and there's a place you can contact them, the Veterans Administration. There's the Army has facilities on Fort Hood for that. And I think that should be your operational mission right now, is to find all the places that specialize in outsourcing, outplacing people like you.
It's a little
Fill out their forms and figure out. Now, what you may need to do is find a way to get some pay while you're getting education that will make you ideal for where there's a high demand job, like in the oil industry. Okay.
Yeah, I'm looking into some of that stuff.
But that's what you got to do.
And, the other thing is, fracking industry, by the way, just as a side note, this is not maybe even a side note, it may be a primary thing. One of the largest components to fracking is chemical cleanup. The difference between why Oklahoma is right up at the number one state for earthquakes now, and Texas is not, is because in Oklahoma they leave all the chemicals in the hole. And that continues to eat up the rock and causes earthquakes. In Texas, it's illegal to do that. We've got to recycle that stuff and use it again. Well, the people that do that have a very peculiar skill set. They're in extremely high demand, and you happen to have that skill set.
And so you have to get the key thing to do is get very proactive, get some testing done, find out what you know. And you may think this is a little goofy, but one of the things you may have to, and I don't know, you may know it very well or not, you may have to brush up on your English usage, you know, your ability to write and your ability to speak. And
you speak Army.
Right.
And that is a specific language, because anybody that doesn't speak Army just looks around like, what language
are they speaking right now?
And in the Army, in my experience, and I was in the Army a long time, your ability to communicate clearly with members of the public is not necessarily a high rating issue when you get promoted in the Army. Whereas in the civilian world, if you can do something and you're disciplined and you also have the ability to communicate about it effectively, that's a tremendous advantage. Okay?
Well, thank you very much for the call, sir. And thank you for your service.
Thank you for your trips to the sandbox.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
All right, we got to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join us, the phone number in here is still 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And that's how we normally begin.
Yeah, that's the beginning of the hour.
So here we are, ladies
back.
And gentlemen, boys and girls, with the final section, about 15 minutes of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. You're welcome to call and back anything, call and ask and comment or something about anything to do with the economy, fiscal policy, investments, and things of that ilk.
I have good news.
Yes.
I know we've been talking other things. We're in a booming economy right now.
I was
everybody's
say that too.
Everybody's talking about good news. So we
talk
let
about
you know
bad news.
The bad news. And usually it's the other way around. Everybody's talking about the bad news and we're talking about the good news. Just keep in mind that that's where we are. But I'm going to throw in some good news anyway because we really are in a booming economy. Housing starts. That's one of the leading indicators for the economy. Housing starts, maybe even the foremost indicator. And we've had some stalls there. The rest of the indicators have been up for a while, but housing starts and existing housing sales have dropped and kind of slumped in the last couple of months. Not much, just a little. And we've looked at it and said, hey, okay, this has more to do with labor shortage than anything else. Well, housing starts for January were up 9.7% year over year. Did you catch that?
Yep.
Let's just say 10%. 9.7, any normal person would say 10%.
Yeah, but they could get completely out of control if they don't put some stops in there, too.
Right.
Housing stops as well as housing
yeah,
starts.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You got to stop the house once you get it started or it just takes off and leaves you. 1.326 million homes at an annualized rate. So what does that mean? We have a big boost to the economy happening there. One big warning about that is that builders tend to get this in their mind. They're saying big housing starts, and they all jump in at the same time. It's very similar to what happened at the beginning of the fracking revolution in oil and gas. Everybody had this grand idea at the same time, and so all the companies got into fracking, and only about 80% of them failed. Because once everybody has the same idea, hey, oil's expensive, let's frack. Once the oil isn't expensive anymore because everybody's fracking, it's basically your business model, which will carry you forward, which means at the beginning of building, you've got to look at profitability, who's buying. You can't do spec houses. I know this is – I'm speaking to probably people that are not listening. If you're a builder, if you own a building company and you build lots and lots and lots of spec houses, that will work this year probably. It won't work forever. The reason why I know this is because this is the normal pattern. It's a cycle in building. You go through this big boom because people have put off buying a house because there's not a lot of cheap houses, and bad times in the economy causes a big housing boom. Houses start being built because there's a demand for them. Everybody gets into the housing market. They start building houses hand over fist. How do you build a house hand over fist? I don't know. Isn't a fist a hand? I don't get that saying, but anyway, once they get started, they don't get stopped. The builders need to be very careful going forward. Do a market analysis. I know that's not a normal construction thing. Look around at what other businesses, other big builders are doing in your area, and make sure that you're not all about to hit the market at the same time. We're starting to see that happen. A lot of building happening.
housing starts are up because people want to buy, and there's people getting back into the construction industry that were not there before because housing prices have come up enough that it's now profitable to hire Americans to do something that 10 years ago we hired someone from more like 15 years ago, we hired someone from another country to do. So keep that in mind if you're a builder. But housing starts are massively up. That's a great boon for the economy. It pushes our good times period out at least through the end of this year and into next year. We're just looking at that, and a 10% boost year over year is, those are numbers you just don't see very often in economics. That sort of thing is, you know, my eyes looked at him. I was, wait a minute. Let me look at that again. I looked at it three times, and it's still shocking to me. Yes, that is the way the number is printed. 10% boost in people buying new houses versus a year ago.
And since we've been talking about bad news coming down the road, in the least in the short to intermediate term, there's nothing but good news out there. Two companies that I watch pretty carefully is to see what's going on in the economy is Caterpillar and John Deere. And both of them are not only reporting record earnings and came in above expectations for fourth quarter 2017 before the tax cut, but are forecasting, and analysts are forecasting, 8 to 10% growth per year in their revenue and profitability, which, by the way, is very frankly is an interesting thing. Caterpillar obviously uses a lot of steel, but Caterpillar is a turnaround company that there was a, years ago, there was a push to provide tariffs. And I don't know if you remember when the Japanese Komatsu and whatever else they were, equipment started showing up in construction sites, and you didn't see Caterpillar anymore. The reason was that Caterpillar was resting on their laurels, and they were using old construction techniques, and they were using old factories, and they had a lot of capital sunk, just like the steel industry in the United States today. And they said, we've got to get competitive. And they were willing to absorb several years of losses. They laid off a lot of people. They automated rather tremendously. And so now they're making a lot more equipment with a lot fewer people. Now, that sounds terrible if you're looking for jobs. But jobs, you can't maintain a huge workforce in a competitive industry. What you got to do is you got to recognize that number one, in most cases, the number one expense is labor, and there's a shortage of labor, and it's going to be expensive. So what any company that's going to be successful and is faced with foreign competition has got to back up and take a look at what they're doing, being willing then to take some hits in their earnings for several years, rethink what they're doing, invest a lot of money, which, by the way, this is a great year to do that in new automation, train their people that they're going to retain, and then move forward very nicely. And both of these companies have done that. One of the reasons that our economy is doing so well right now and continues to do well, look, to give you an example, Caterpillar, a U.S. company, mostly operating in the United States with mostly U.S. workers, is the largest construction equipment manufacturing and sales company in the world. It's got 20% of the world market, which is big, the world market. Now, by the way, the tax, for whatever, a little footnote here, a little piece of trivia, they had reorganized so that they're in Switzerland, believe it or not, so that their profits would all show up in Switzerland, and they just got hit with a big tax bill. But that's beside the point. And whether they're going to bring any of that money back is questionable. It's a little bit complicated. What happens is they borrow here at low interest rates using the collateral in Switzerland as collateral, and it was cheaper than bringing the money back. But when I look at Caterpillar and I look at John Deere and I look at housing starts that Jake was just talking about, we are in a healthy expansion. Technically, we can look at the numbers and say we got a good 6 months to a year of no sign on the horizon. Nothing's on the radar that would indicate a recession. But we are probably going to overheat as an economy out around end of 2019 and going into 2020. And at that point, we'll either get stagflation or a recession. Now, I don't know this for certain. Things could change. But I do want to emphasize in our discussion, negative discussions about what's going to happen that far out, that in the short term, we're on a roll. The United States economy is doing wonderfully. We have come out of the 2008-2009 recession, rebuilt a lot of stuff as a result of that, particularly in the financial side of things, and are likely to do very, very well for the next 1.5 to 2 years. I just wanted to say that positive. We're generally focused about 3 years out, which means we see some storm clouds coming 3 years out. We like to warn people about it because I don't think anybody else is, at least at the public level.
I'm going to throw something else out there, something we talked about a lot in the last several years. It's been kind of on the back burner because it's an unknown thing, and that's the DOL's fiduciary rule. Anybody that's followed that or listened to us for very long knows we've been following it. We function primarily as fiduciary to our clients, and this concept of having a fiduciary.
I think we function, period, not just primarily.
Right. And well, I was saying we, and in effect, we function as a fiduciary.
Period.
Period.
Right.
Yeah. So this concept that as a fiduciary, someone's supposed to give you unconflicted advice with full disclosure of fees and even playing field. It's a open area, except that in an effort to push back over regulation, the Trump administration has delayed this rule. So it's
actually they've delayed enforcement. The rule's still in
place. Right. They delayed enforcement. So the rule exists. It says that if you're dealing with a retirement account, whether it's an IRA or a 401k, the person giving advice must be acting as a fiduciary, but nobody's enforcing it. Well, I shouldn't say nobody, because the state of Massachusetts.
Yes, Mr. Galvin.
And what we're going to find is that states are now going to be holding companies responsible for following federal law, because there is a federal law on the books that says you will be a fiduciary when dealing with retirement products. The state of Massachusetts has just snagged Scottrade with a DOL fiduciary rule, a whole bunch of violations. And they'll be seeing each other in court or in the world of paying large fines in the near future, because people think of Scottrade and a lot of the other online discount brokers, oh, well, they've got to be an even playing field, right? They're just a discount broker. No, they recommend positions based on what you're looking at for your IRAs and everything else that pay them more. They have them at the top of the list. This is something we've talked about in the past. They don't disclose that. And Massachusetts says, hey, you got to show what the fees are clearly when you're talking about a retirement account. I don't know anybody that gets upset with the idea of knowing what you're going to pay for something before you pay it. I mean, this is one of the biggest frustrations on buying a plane ticket right now, is you see the listed price and you don't know if that's really what you're going to pay when you show up. Are they going to charge you for bags? What are they going to do? Are they going to say, well, you paid for the ticket, but now you need to actually buy a seat? Well, wait a minute. So knowing what you're paying for, I think that's a pretty reasonable request, particularly when we're considering that if this isn't taken care of well, you're going to be resting on the taxpayer in your retirement. And I would rather have people be planning ahead and knowing what the expenses are in advance instead of losing a bunch of money and then requiring Social Security to pay for stuff because it's running out of money.
And at the risk of being unduly technical, I want to say what Scottrade did. Scottrade is theoretically a discount broker-dealer. And you automatically expect it if you contact a discount broker-dealer like Schwab or Scottrade or Fidelity Discount or something, that they're going to give you objective advice. In fact, and this, by the way, has apparently been happening at the other places too, because Fidelity just got hammered on it, they were running sales contests. And you get points on the sales contest to Scottrade if you recommended a proprietary product that was more expensive when somebody rolled over an IRA.
whoops, well, that's against the law now, guys.
And what happened was they were trying to get their, they were about to merge. I don't remember who they merged with, but they were trying to get a good price for the company as they merged into another company. And so there
TD
was,
Ameritrade.
TD Ameritrade was buying them.
They bought them in September.
And what happened was in the run-up to that, trying to get, because it was based on their profits at the time of the purchase, whatever, what they get paid for it, the executives pushed for the, and they got this sales contest going so that the higher commission, the higher, and believe me, even discount brokers get commissions. The higher commission products are the ones they'd sell in these big IRA rollovers. And that's one of those things that's going on routinely in the big wide world that you don't even know about.
It's worth knowing about. It's worth knowing that it's not an even playing field. And if you don't know about it, then you're the one that's damaged. So we're about out of time for this week. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we actually do give fiduciary investment advice to folks that can use it. The phone number locally is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. And you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com to listen to podcasts, read our newsletter, read about philosophy and all that good stuff. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to, on that webpage, you can see our made for radio faces. Until next week, this is the Personal Wealth Coach.
Belton Killeen Fort Hood, proud to broadcast to the largest military post in the free world. News Radio 1400 KTEM.